Good evening, buddies.
Hey, buddies.
Seeing you guys again at the Comics Claptrap Zoom edition. How is everybody? Everyone's good? Everyone's doing their comics, writing, drawing, being productive. I'm excited that we have for our guest this evening. She is an NAACP award nominated cartoonist, author, ethnographer. Yeah, this is a very smart woman. So I don't know how we're going to keep up. She is a recipient of the 2017 Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and is nominated, you guys, for all you comic nerds out there, for 2 Eisner Awards this year.
Wow.
For her book, Hot Comb, which is a collection of stories about Black women from various generations and the relationship with their hair and how their hair has shaped identities, ideas of identity, culture, race, and memory. And so we welcome to the program, very excited, Dr. Ebony Flowers.
Whoa! Yay!
Yeah. That's
amazing. Wow, that was totally worth it.
I'm excited. First off, just to get the comics nerd thing out of the way, how did you react when you found out you were nominated for 2 Eisner Awards for a debut? And I forgot to mention, this is a debut book, graphic novel, first ever.
So I've been shocked by everything, you know, because I do have a degree, like a higher degree that's not in like making art at all. So when I made these comics, I wasn't really making them. I wasn't making them at all with the plan of making a book called Hot Comb. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I got the Rona Jaffe Award, which that was very unexpected. They give you money when you win that. So I felt like, okay, they're giving me money to do this thing that was kind of like a hobby while I was getting my PhD. So maybe I should stay true to the other people who have won and make a book. So that's how Hot Comb came about, but it wasn't intended to do it. So I was a little terrified initially, knowing that lots of people I don't know have been reading my book, but it's been a pleasant response. And so the Eisner, I don't know. It's weird. I was there last year. The Comic-Con for Hot Comb.
Were you? Oh.
Oh, yeah. That's when it kind of debuted, it was last year.
Yeah, it was there, and my son was 5 weeks old.
Oh, no.
There, too.
Who made you go to the Eisner, though?
No one did. Oh, my. No one made me go.
You just went on your own?
No, I did not go.
Oh, okay, good.
So
good.
I actually wish I was there this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I don't want to be there because there's a deadly virus looming. But there's some really great people who have also been nominated, and I felt like a lot of black people. And then my old boss was nominated. And then someone I wish I, Linda Berry, she's my old boss. And then someone I really want to learn how to make comics from, Ivan Brunetti. He was nominated too. I don't know if they would have showed up, but I feel like it would have been like a very nice happy hour.
How's Linda Berry your boss? Were you like thinking?
So she lives in Wisconsin. She's from Wisconsin originally, like way back. And then she spent most of her life in Seattle, I think. Nice. Anyway, so she came back to Wisconsin, and I don't know what she was doing, but at some point she ended up at the University of Wisconsin as a artist in residence. And at that time, I think I was getting my master's degree, and I was looking for another way of representing my research. This can get really academic.
Yeah,
real fast, but I'm not gonna go down that Anyway, I was just looking for a different way of representing
my research. I was looking forward to that.
But anyway, so I was looking for this other way of doing my research, and I just started looking at like lots of different classes that I could take, and I came across her Artists in Residence class. Huh. And her poster for it, I don't know if you people who are familiar with her work, you know how her posters are just like a ton of collage. I think she like there was some like stitching involved in there too, and there was glitter on it. And so I signed up for a class, I got in, and I didn't know who she was because I wasn't into comics at all. I don't have an artist background. My background's in biology and anthropology. And so anyway, so she taught this class. I loved the class. And then she took a semester off because the artist in residence is only for a semester. And then she came back. She skipped a semester and then she came back as a TA. It was something weird. So she was like getting paid like peanuts. But then she got, she was hired on as a professor. And so I took a few more of her classes, and then this place called the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery opened up, and it's an interdisciplinary research workspace for people who are in lots of different fields. So like you have folks in like biology, different biology fields, and like mathematicians there alongside folks who are more in the social sciences, and I'm in education. So there are some people in education there, and then some artistic folks. And Linda talked to the director of the institute at the time, David Krakauer, and they, I don't know what they did, but it ended up with Linda having her own research space called the Image Lab. And she was looking at how creativity was contagious, and looking at different ways that people who don't think that they can draw use drawing in their own research and understanding and developing their own expertise. And so she hired me on as her assistant in the Image Lab. And so is that for like pretty much until I graduated. So that's why she was, she's my old boss. Wow. Cool. I always refer to her as my old boss.
Yeah, there's not many, many people that can say that. Like Linda Perry is my old boss.
Yeah, I think this is her like first legit job. She said. It's her first. And besides, like I think she was a janitor, but besides that, this was professor. It's her first legit job, so she was able to hire people too. So
cool.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how you kind of got into comics, I guess by accident, you know, and then how, I just wondered how, what do you think about comics now? Are you reading a bunch of comics, or is this just like, you know, are you diving into it? I mean, I know that you took, you know, Linda Berry is a mentor and your boss, but or are you just sort of like, this is just specific to what I do, or, you know, I'm just curious what you're.
I mean, I read more comics than I have ever done in my life before. Yeah. So I'm 39 now, and I took my first class with Linda, I think when I was 31. Mm-hmm. So I've been drawing for like 8 years. And also reading comics in those 8 years. Like prior to that, I literally never read comics. It was something that I thought it was something that white people did. And it wasn't for me. And so I just never got into it. It wasn't a thing. And I wasn't, my family wasn't really big on reading either. It was funny, like one of my first panels I did for Hot Comb was at this the Texas Library Association conference. And one of the questions like, what books did you read in middle school? And I was just like, wasn't even a nerd, because I think nerds are like cool people. I was like a total dork. My favorite book was a biology textbook. Like that's all I did was I played sports, I read textbooks, and I watched a ton of TV. Like I never read like, what are those? Like I think the Babysitter's Clubs has a series out. I never read any of those books. I just never was attached to books like that.
It must be such an interesting, like for most of us that are into comics, we love comics or read comics our lives, you know? You know, with starting with like really bad superhero stuff, and then, you know, like growing up and getting more into like stuff like Linda Barry
and
Ivor Brunetti and stuff like that. So I think it's such a fun idea that you're discovering comics at like a later stage in life, you know? Like, I wonder, I would love to see how I would react to comics like now, you know, as a 40-year-old or something like that, just to be.
I feel like that's probably going to be become more commonplace as there are more comics, you know, for different people, like about different subjects and all kinds of, you know, and for grown-ups, you know, like I think that a lot of old-time comic nerds grew up on those, you know, kind of juvenile things because that's what was available. But now with so much flourishing, it seems like probably more people are going to come to it later, like when they just happen across a cool book.
Yeah.
I hope more people draw comics. Yeah. I know that it took me a while to, and it still does, like, because reading a comic is very different from reading a book or even at like a textbook. And so that took me a while to figure out how to do. So I'm not just like reading the narration or whatever, the dialogue, and just saying yeah, finishing it in like, you know, 10 minutes, even though it took the person who made it like 15 years to draw this thing. Mm-hmm. But but I do, like, I'm trying to think of the last comic I read. So I have a kid, right? So it's hard to like read.
To sit down.
To actually have a hard copy of something. Because he tears up everything. He's in that tearing phase. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he'll ever outgrow it. But
how he's communicating right now.
Yeah, it's just like, shh. I read Upgrade Soul on the phone. I'm doing this, but it was a phone.
It's the whole flip phone.
Like on a phone.
You have to test this.
Yeah, Ezra's book. And I just read it because it was, I think for a while it was free or significantly discounted. And then it was just on a phone, so I could just kind of do it real fast. All taking care of my son. So
yeah,
that was the last comic I read.
Hey, before we get too far into this, I want to make sure we talk about your book. So for, I don't know, like,
so humble.
For listeners or viewers who haven't read it.
No, it's because I'm working on my second book. And
We're going to talk about that too.
Is that a scoop?
Okay.
No, I mean, it is news. It's recent news I wanted to talk about. But let's talk about Hot Comb first.
Yeah, I mean, how would you describe Hot Comb to people who haven't read it?
So Hot Comb is a collection of short stories that include fiction and nonfiction. Wow. And there's all stories that loosely revolve around Black women's hair. And they deal with like broader themes of family, place, and belonging, along with the vestiges. It's all kind of like wrapped around the vestiges of racism, classism, and sexism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also have some. I don't know how many, but I included a few of my hair product ad parody advertisements.
Yep.
I stopped doing them, but for a while I was just doing them for shits and giggles, and then I showed it. So it's published by Drawn and Quarterly, and Tracy is the editor there, and I showed them to Tracy, and she was like, yeah, we should put them in there. So some of them are spoofs off of hair product ads that are older hair product ads in like Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, Essence. Mm-hmm. I don't think I No, I'm not a big Essence fan. They say that, but like, no, let me scratch that. I am a big Essence fan. I would love to go to their festival, whatever COVID is.
Yeah.
But if it was between Essence and like Jet, I'd probably pick up the Jet magazine first. So, and some of the stories are longer fiction. So I think the longest one is Hot Comb. It's the story Hot Comb, which is autobiographical, and it's about, I think it's about 40 pages long. And then there's some that are, they're not really even stories, but just like events that are like 2 and 4 pages long.
I'm glad that you told me that it was fictional and nonfiction, because when I was reading it, I constantly had to, I was like, wait, like I was trying to reference to see like who this person was in your particular life, you know? And I think that's like, for me, I think that's a great testament to how great a writer you are, because even when you were writing the nonfiction, the characters were so real, you know? And it just felt like you knew the characters so well that like I just assumed that it was all nonfiction. It was all taken from your life, you know?
Oh, thank you for saying that. It's all made up. Well, not all of it, but a lot of it is made up.
Yeah, my favorite story is the one about grandma's the funeral.
That's a
story. That's a story where I was constantly like, wait, is she Cora? Or, you know, which, you know, which character is she? And because it just felt so real to me, like it really felt like something that happened, you know, like, you know, like when you read fiction, it's pretty easy to, and then when you read nonfiction, it's sometimes pretty easy to be like, oh yeah, this is not autobiographical, because, you know, there's, you know, you can just feel it. But here I just felt like, now I'm glad, because I thought it was going crazy. I love your writing is so, you know, it just felt so real. Everything, the characters just felt like, you know, you knew them so well. So
yeah, well, Big Ma is so I came of age in and around Baltimore around the time of the crack epidemic. And so I had like personal experience with that, and then I think I made that at around the time people stopped talking about it now, but during the opioid crisis, I think it's still a crisis, but there's so many.
Yeah, there's so many
crisis. But I laugh to keep from crying. But you know, kind of people have stopped talking about it. But so I was thinking about the opioid epidemic now and how much attention it's been getting. And during the time during the crack epidemic, when I was a kid then, but I don't remember it being talked about as much on the news or like. Mm-hmm. Like as part of the regular conversation, and maybe it's because I was so young, but and it could also just be because of racism.
It's just for sure because of racism.
Because of systemic racism, right? yeah, but so anyway, that's what inspired me to do it, because I felt like, you know, well, now that people are talking about this opioid epidemic, maybe we can also say, well, remember the crack epidemic? Mm. Let's not repeat.
I like that you didn't even really say crack in the whole story, but knew it. We all felt it. You know, as soon as in that story, as soon as they said, when they're talking about like her taking the ring. You knew, like, you felt it, you know, like you felt something was looming. It was really, it's really well done. Good job.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I did that when I think I was pregnant.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not that it's a big deal, but it's, everything was much harder for me when I was pregnant.
All of these, you kind of mentioned that you were doing these stories as a hobby. It sounds like you didn't have an ambition to put out like a graphic novel, say. So I don't know, can you talk a little bit more about that? Like why you were doing them, or how you chose to do it, one about this or that? And then I guess I'm kind of curious about the the running theme about hair, whether that was like something you were intentionally putting throughout, or if you just looked at like this mass of stories that you had after a while and saw that theme, or what the process was.
Yeah, so I was writing my dissertation at around the same time as I did a lot of these stories, and that was a very stressful process. It was very stressful. And so as a stress reliever, I started making these stories. My dissertation is also, it's not really a comic, it's more of like a zine. So it's a mix of like comics and then more formal academic writing.
I would like to see that.
Yeah.
I would love to see that version of this.
Sign a contract for that.
I feel like I need it. Yeah. But you know, fiction, doing fiction is so much more fun. I really don't want to copy edit a dissertation. So I was doing these stories as a stress reliever, and the hair theme just basically came about. I'm trying to remember. It wasn't intentional, but with a lot of the exercises, especially with working with Linda, there are these like daily exercises that you do where, you know, you're writing and drawing on big themes like, you know, teeth, car, hair was, I'm sure I wrote hair a few times when we were doing these like daily exercises. And so a lot of my comics in some form or fashion kind of dealt with hair enough so that I could pile a whole bunch of them together once this Rana Jaffe thing came around, and I could say, okay, if I made like two more stories and then just throw in some random hair ads, hair product ads, then, you know, it could be something, maybe.
So do you have a pile of like a ton of other stories that like from those exercises that didn't make this collection?
I do. And they could be something. It's not for my second book, but maybe for the third book, I'm thinking about doing a few of them to see what I can. I don't want to say too much because I'm still doing a second book, but my third book, I'm thinking I can pull some out from the vault.
Very cool.
Does it feel different to draw comics when you didn't have any expectations that it was going to be published or anything was going to come of it?
Yes.
this is a running theme of our show, where we talk about the pressures of like when you're going to get published and how hard it is to draw comics when that's the case. But I would love to hear your experience about it.
So the main thing is, so like when I'm just kind of like doing comics for like shits and giggles, and this is like for everyone, right? No one cares about like where periods and commas go. No one cares if your thumb is kind of like dangling or like maybe it's on the wrong side of the hand. You just kind of like keep going because the whole point is to like finish the story that you're trying to get out. Now knowing that there's like an audience, I think Hot Comb, a lot of my stories, I mean, they look like they came from a sketchbook because they pretty much did. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm thinking more along the lines of, okay, I probably shouldn't eat like chips while I'm inking because people, if I get a grease stain, then I'm gonna have to like redo this whole thing. And yeah, so I treat it more like it's a little bit more precious than I treat it more like it's a little bit more precious than I would with like my comics I just mess around with.
No, I think that's interesting though. Yeah. The Oxford comma.
We only just stopped eating chips while podcasting.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I know, that's why when you said chips, I'm like, oh, because for a while when we were just podcasters and not videographers, we would just be eating chips while we talked, and we got a bunch of criticism. Well, Tint was the one who did all the.
Well, I'm still gonna. I'm gonna get up and get some ice cream.
Yeah.
But I want to ask one last.
Yeah. Question. Are you gonna ask it? I was gonna ask a question.
I see. Your that freshness that you're talking about, as opposed to like something you do in a sketchbook in Hot Comb itself. Like, I feel like some of the stories, or some of the art, the stories are consistently great, and there's the very like in the very similar voice. But some of the stories are done a lot more. It just seems like there's a lot more care. Like you concentrated on it a lot more. Like I thought the Big Ma story with the gray tones and the beautiful, like it seemed like this was like you were sitting down and being like, I'm not eating chips. Where some of the stories have that energy of like,
yeah.
an energy and immediacy of like, I just want to get this down and it's exciting.
Yeah.
It's like two different feelings. They're both great, but like I you really see that in the book. I think it's really cool.
Well, the story Hot Comb, I did that one. I know there were days. So when I was doing my dissertation, I was also working and not sleeping much and moving around a lot. And I was also like tutoring some college students who are in STEM fields and like freaking out and mentoring them. And so it was kind of like all over the place. And so I needed to have paper that was small enough for me to like stick in my backpack and go to places. And so Hot Comb is done on 8.5 by 11 paper. And Big Ma is done on larger paper. And so I had more space to like fit everything in. and then I did Big Ma, like, I think I did that one after Rana Jaffe. So that was more intentional, like this is going to be part of a collection of books. And I was actually thinking about redoing Hot Comb. I don't know, Drawn and Quarterly, they didn't say like, oh, you should redo that story. And I was like, all right.
I love both. I mean,
yeah.
I think I started the same way. I think a lot of my comics started with I'm just on a typewriting paper just because I like to carry that around. It was easier. And then sometimes you have more room and more technology and all this stuff, but then like you lose a lot of like the energy and immediacy of the art, you know, and then so and because it's more polished. But I enjoy both styles, and I do like seeing the difference between them.
But I think it also flowed really well. I mean, you were saying that like it didn't seem like these were all sort of different stories, and just you can sometimes you can tell, right? You like get a collection of stories, like, oh, that happened that time, and then she was trying this. But it felt like it flowed naturally. It became this one long piece, and just you know, also with the running theme. But what I liked. What I love is like what Tin was saying, it's just the art and how the art was expressive. And
you should know. Expressive. You make expressive artwork.
And that's what I loved about it is that how spontaneous and expressive that came, that shined through. Yeah. And I've always had this struggle between, well, what's my real style and what's the professional cartoonist style?
And so that's a thing that, yeah. Okay, so style. So
the whole preciousness, too, when you're talking about that, is like,
I never heard of style.
That? Yeah, yeah.
Look, go ahead, sorry to cut you off.
No, but I just wonder if you ever thought about, like, personal style, or just, like, I know that there are a lot of different, like, artists that, like, we just talked to Chuck Forsman. And how he said he doesn't really have one. He just kind of like every single different comic is different, you know. So it's sort of like you can't tell that he's the author of all these different things. But just like owning that, maybe like for me, but personally, let's talk about me. Have personally like just like owning this certain style. Like, oh, my style is the sketchy sketchbook style, and that's good, and that's fine, and that looks good in a graphic novel type. Format, like, do you ever think about that? Like, you know, should I be drawing, like, doing my panels and making sure that you know there are gutters and thinking?
No, I just learned what a gutter. I love was, that. So
I still don't know what that is. I still don't know. But
No, I never think about style, and it's a word that I was introduced to when people started asking me about it. And I realized, oh, this is a thing that artists are concerned about. And it's kind of like with the, I don't know, with academics, it's like they're trying to figure out like who you read. So the theory that's driving your work. And then with storytelling, it's the new word that I learned last year was world building. someone asked me about that, and I had to ask them, what do you mean by world building?
Did they know?
They did. They explained it to me. Okay. I will not repeat it because I'm sure I'll butcher it. But so I do think about theory in that when I do academic work. I don't think about the term world building, but because my background is in anthropology, I think a lot about how people have lived their lives and the places, what their place, where they lived, where how that was like, what they did for work, and how did that feel like, and stuff like And so that's kind of a kind of world building, but it's not drawn from like any kind of literary tradition. Because if I tried to, I just finished reading Britt Bennett's book, The Vanishing Half, and it's about twins who separate and then come back together. And it's about colorism in amongst the Black American community. And she, so when I was reading the reviews, there's a lot of like conversations about world building and her building up her characters and stuff. And they draw from all these different like histories of literary fiction. And I'm like, damn, did she really think, I don't know if she thought about all of those things, but I wouldn't be surprised if there is some kind of like sophisticated like research or drawing upon some sort of literary tradition that was intentional as she wrote this, because, you know, she does have an MFA, and I think that's what people do when they get MFAs. They study this kind of work, but I don't have that background, so.
People always talk about like, oh, this is an exciting new voice in comics. And, you know, the person usually has been drawing comics and doing all this for a long time. But like, when we said, you're an exciting voice in a new voice in comics, you're like a new voice in comics. I love that you like, are like, oh, I just learned about style.
Well, it's interesting, like what people talk about. But then I realized, oh, maybe these are folks. These are folks who probably have some sort of art background. And at some point in their education, they were interrogated by whoever, their advisor or other peers about this thing called style, because that's the thing that will make, that will set you apart from everyone else and then make you like a star or whatever. So it's just interesting to like see what people obsess over and care about. So I don't know, maybe I do have a particular style, and I'm sure that people I will never read about them, what they say about it. But,
I think that's the thing, that like in every community, there's all these words and buzzwords. They all kind of, there's it all means the similar things in different communities. Like when I was, when I started teaching high school, and then I started talking.
What did you teach?
I teach computer art. I'm an art teacher. Oh. Yeah. But when I started teaching it and going to all these meetings, all these people would talk at me with academic terms, you know, like I remember one of the terms was scaffolding, and I had no idea what that was. And people were talking about scaffolding and putting things in silos and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, you know, I came from an art background. I don't know what you're talking about, until I realized scaffolding is basically just like outlining a story, you know? So it's sort of like, all these terms are just different in other
same,
But like you just discovered that, like, you know, like a lot of the stuff that you've been doing, world building in, you know, anthropology community, is basically world building in comics, you know? So
yeah,
that's like a cool discovery to have.
It is. and I try, I'm not embarrassed when I ask those questions, but I'm sure I do look naive when I'm like, what's world building?
When you you thank Linda Berry at the in your acknowledgments for showing you the writing and drawing and the drawing and writing, what does that mean?
So like when I was getting my PhD, and even before, just kind of like moving through this world, I was not much of a writer prior to my work at Wisconsin. And I studied the subjects I studied as an undergrad for a reason, and that was because I never considered myself to be a writer. And the idea of writing long papers was just like, now just give me like a formula to solve. And so it was with her class where I learned how to really see when I go through my day, like how to really notice things and notice what I notice, and just that kind of hyper awareness, not all the time because it's like absolutely exhausting, and but it is a useful tool when writing, because especially when doing academic work where there tends to be a lot of abstract thinking that's put down on paper and kind of is hard to digest unless you're in that field. Mm-hmm. And so what she did for me was teach me how to write in a way where I can picture what it is I want to show and tell, to make it more digestible for myself and then for other folks who are reading. And then also there's a kind of flow, I think, to making comics and drawing pictures, at least the way I go about it, where there's, I want to say grammar, but then I don't want to say it, but I'm just going to say it. There's like a
language,
kind of a
language? Structure.
Yeah, it's just like a structure that's similar to writing that shows up in making comics. Yeah. And there's a, like a flow to that. And I think it's helpful to make comics by hand to experience that flow, as well as like writing by hand to kind of experience that that exchange between the writing and the drawing, the blending. And then there's also whatever I write now, especially since I'm doing mostly fiction work now, and then especially with my comics, I always try to enter this more playful space. And it's really hard, especially as an adult, where you know, like looking at a blank page, like, yeah, you know, could give me diarrhea, maybe not, I don't know. It's just like very intimidating sometimes. But I try to, and these are like where like doing daily exercises and doing very quick drawings and quick writing exercises come into play. But I try to enter this kind of like more playful space where I'm more open to storytelling that would freak me out in any other context. Like if I'm being critical of my work or my thoughts, you know, or fearful of them, I wouldn't like necessarily write or draw them down. It would bury them deep inside of me for I don't know, for medication to solve, but I don't know. But yeah, so it just, so seeing the writing and drawing and the drawing and writing is also a way for me to remember that my daily writing and drawing exercises are a way for me to enter a more playful space where I'm more open and receptive to whatever stories emerge from me. And I'm more fearless in that process, because it can be really scary.
Oh, so
you,
yeah,
create a like a really, you know, fucked,
well,
up
just
character.
Like this, yeah,
a really messed up character. you know. Anyway, you're like, wow.
Okay, no, shit. I think that's amazing. Yeah, she's intense. No, I think that's cool to understand. You know, that especially like that just the whole Linda Barry experience is so, I guess, accessible, like makes writing accessible, or it, not easy, but just like a great entry point for someone who is not used to writing, like doing writing is a form of storytelling versus documenting, I guess, and also writing fiction, which is not what you're used to, or creating a different world, or these characters that you've never had or never met before. And I think, you know, I think that's, I was going to just say, so I guess I assume that you're using Linda Barry techniques for the second book, to figure that out, or are you, and first let's talk about like what you, maybe you could talk a little bit what the second book is about. I know that it's called Baltimore. Yeah, Baltimore Brownfield. It just got
which
announced.
Which is a tentative,
working title. Yeah, you need to call it a working title, because that's just professional. The working title is, Baltimore Brownfield. It was it's with Drawn and Quarterly again, which is amazing. But if you would want to talk a little bit, can you talk a little bit about it? And I guess also maybe just like your approach to it.
Cool. Various pages are scattered.
Nice.
Like over here.
I love that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So Baltimore Brownfield, which is a working title. It's a fiction story that's very loosely based around a place where my mother and father grew up in Baltimore. So they grew up in different neighborhoods. So my mother grew up in a place called Fairfield, which was a neighborhood that no longer exists. It was zoned for mixed industrial use for like hundreds of years. And for decades, the city was trying to push the folks who lived there out so they could change it all over into an industrial space, which they ultimately ended up doing. And so, and then my father grew up in a place called Solace Homes, spelled S-O-L-L-E-R-S, but that's how Solers is Solace when you are from Baltimore. And it was a temporary housing for Black World War II vets. And it was dilapidated housing. And so all the residents of that place were forced to leave because the homes were not actually fit for people to live. And so the story revolves around an event that actually happened that I got from the Baltimore Sun. And there was a sulfuric acid spill from one of the trains, just spilled over, and it kind of spilled into the community. And the rest of the book is fiction, but it basically looks at the degradation of a community over time. And there's some resiliency, but I'm trying to make it, we'll see if it becomes upbeat. I'll let that be for the people who read it and see what they think. But it basically looks at the degradation of a community and how a community resilience over time kind of falls apart, with the ultimate ending being that everyone is forced to leave. Yeah.
It's exciting.
So is there
so
a
depressing.
Lot of
I didn't know. That's awesome.
I want to talk about, you know, I mean, well, first we can talk about the research that might be going on with that story, but also do you feel like a response, like pressure or responsibility to like depict certain communities or like people of color, you know, the Black community? Do you ever feel the pressure to be like, this is my responsibility to be talking about a whole group of people, you know? I think about that with my own stories about like Filipino communities and how they're not as represented as much, and it's so feel like you have this like duty to talk, you know? It's like, especially in comics where it's, you know, like you said, it's like, oh, I thought like white people do call, you know, and it's just like you have that
it's true though
sense. Yeah. Have that sense of that, you know, I'm one of like a handful of people of color doing this.
No, I was going to show you a page from this, but I'll answer that.
That looks right big.
I'm doing 8.5 by 11 again because it's just, I don't know, I like working in this size, and I think it's because I can work in the backyard, kind of.
That looks great. Porch.
Whoa.
Wow, that's a lot of material.
That is a lot. Wow, you're almost done.
No, I wish. Thank you for saying that. Hey,
that looks really thick.
That looks like a lot of stuff.
Ship it.
That's it. That's all it.
No, I'm nowhere near.
That's great.
So I don't feel a responsibility. That's a heavy burden to bear. But I do feel like the folks who have come before in writing like fiction books, like Octavia Butler, and I'm not saying I'm along the lines of them, but like Octavia Butler and like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin, they've done a lot of the heavy lifting where they've had to like write in a particular way to show that Black people can write without having I think Toni Morrison said like the little white man sitting on your shoulder, like telling you what to do. And so I do feel like I have more of freedom to write the stories and draw the stories that I want to tell and that I want to come out of me without feeling like, any kind of this kind of outside pressure to write in a or draw in a particular way. And so these are the stories that I want to tell, not necessarily something I feel like I have to tell. Mm-hmm. And with Baltimore Brownfield in particular, because I'm a dork, not a nerd, I've been doing a lot of reading and not really research, but it's more of like a literature review of housing discrimination and working class communities in like the shipping yards that are particular to Baltimore and the steel mill factories there in Baltimore and in Pittsburgh, just to get a sense of these kind of communities that were developed and built around industry. And what happened to those places once the industry disappeared. And not all stories are similar to the one I'm trying to tell, but the sentiment and a lot of the discrimination that particularly like Black workers faced at that time is there. And it's really helpful. And so I don't know what I'll do with that. I feel like the books and the journals that articles I'm reading, I don't know if people would be into it, but I don't know. I just feel like sometimes, like when people do this kind of research for writing fiction, it's nice to know what they're reading and who they're reading. So I might, I don't know, maybe include like a little works cited page of the stuff I read. Because it's definitely out of my jurisdiction.
Yeah.
It's definitely super interesting. I love looking at that part when I read a graphic novel, just to like, I know that like a lot of it doesn't make it into the book, but the idea that like all this like creates a world in your head, world builds in your head is like so valuable, you know?
Yeah, I never thought I'd be like really into labor history. I thought that was something for the sociologists. Like, oh, that's what y'all do. I don't do that. But it's really fascinating about labor history in this country and. Unfortunately, looking at the present day and seeing how a lot of what folks were fighting for back then, there's still some residue here now.
Yeah. Is it? Do you get like super angry when you do this research? You know, like even more angry. You know what I mean? Like you're like, oh, this is so unfair. You know, whenever I read things like that, that's how I get. I'm always like, oh, I'm so mad.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff I read getting my PhD, so it prepared me to like channel my anger. So the only thing that really made that's really made me angry so far was reading the Kerner report about that was done. The federal government wrote this very long report. It's like at least 1,000 pages, if not more. That was done around the 68 riots. And it talked about how they were trying to figure out why this happened. And basically, the government admitted that systemic racism is a thing, and that there have been decades, if not centuries, of discrimination against Black people. Intentional, not like, you know, unexpected, but very intentional policies put up in place to prevent Black Americans from flourishing in this country. And that moving forward, these are the steps, and they've outlined the steps. These are steps that need to be taken in order for for the scale to kind of even out more. And none of those steps have been taken. And that was done in 68. So that was that angered me. And then I watched a documentary about Black American steel workers in Pittsburgh, and watching like very old. The documentary was done in 1990 by a guy named I wrote his name down. It's not here. I think his name was like Tony Bubba. It was like a really nice name. I was like, that's a good name. And he interviewed these old guys who worked in the steel mill factories in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And just like what they had to go through. And there were several men who cried, and like, and these are things that happened like way, way back, and it still made them cry. And I broke down and cried when I watched that documentary. So yeah. But other than that, I'm like, eh, all right. I'm not like man, but I'm like, okay. This again. It's frustrating more than like infuriating. It's just frustrating. Yeah.
What was your dissertation on?
It was on creativity and education and how people use drawing as a way to make new meaning about the world. So I was looking at grad students and preschoolers and how they draw together and then apart to make meaning.
That's awesome. I want to read that.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds pretty fascinating.
It was fun. It's more fun to like play with preschoolers. I was never like a kid person. Like that's why I taught high school, because it's just like middle school or lower. It's just like no.
Yes.
Like
I agree.
So yeah. Working with preschoolers for my dissertation was very intimidating in the beginning. But it was good. They're exhausting.
Does it feel a lot harder or easier to do one long story? Is this new one going to be one long story as opposed to a lot of short stories?
So that's hard. So I'm a new mom. I'm still saying that even though he's 13 months old.
13 months.
Well, no, that never
He'll
ends.
He'll be like 18 and I'll be like, I'm a new mom.
It goes fast. So,
I'm a new mom. It's hard, but I don't know if it's necessarily because it's a longer story. I think it's because we're in the middle of a pandemic. Childcare options are non-existent. And even if there were options, there's starting to be some options in Denver. Until there's a vaccine, I won't feel comfortable to explore those. And so trying to juggle parenting him and being a mothering him with making comics and doing all the side things that bring in some money, it's kind of hard. Sometimes I sit, it's when I'm able to sit down, I'm like, what am I doing? But I had to take very small steps, like And then also being pregnant too, I was very uncomfortable. And so I never really wanted to sit for very long. And making comics is a thing for most people. I don't know if other people stand or whatever, but most of the time it involves sitting. it was hard for me to do that. So I don't know, making a longer story, I think it's hard because I'm also juggling all these other things that, you know, a lot of parents are also juggling at the same time, which is what to do with your kid.
Yeah. Well, these guys know, right?
What are you guys doing?
I kind of forgot about the baby days. but I have been talking to other cartoonists and they're trying to figure that out, and it is not easy. I actually have no solutions at all.
Yeah.
Especially right now, I don't know. I mean, there aren't any. There are not a lot of opportunities.
If they're a little older, you can just give them an iPad and just let them.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you, though? Can you? Like, I don't know. I feel like every stage has their own challenges. Yeah.
I don't have a kid. I'm the only one that doesn't have a kid. Advice.
When he babysits, yeah. That's what he does.
Yeah, that's that was what my son was doing when he was with Tim.
Yeah, yeah. When I babysat your kid, you give him an iPad.
Yeah, that was TV. a very desperate moment.
Waking up early, maybe, but that's awful for a lot of people, including me.
Yeah.
Because it was just until recently that he'd been sleeping through the night. Maybe sometimes I stay up really late at night. I'm married, so I am lucky that, you know, we can kind of, we're both quarantined and furloughed in some form or fashion, so there is like that kind of downtime. but it's still
downtime.
It's still not easy, but I'm getting some stuff done.
But look at that.
It helps to have deadlines.
I don't know. Well, I am.
You have back there, though. I love that. So I've been looking at this.
Just go in there. Just go in there and do the comics.
I just want to crawl in there and do comics all day long inside the castle or the tent, whatever that is.
I have found out that, like, yeah, like, I don't really have a studio anymore. My son's room was my studio. And so I've been. When I was making my book, I was just sort of finding different places to draw it. And I think this last one, I was later stages, I was drawing underneath his, you know, he has a bunk bed. And so I was under his bunk bed, this little area underneath his bunk bed, because that was the most quiet place. I said, I'm going to go into your room. I said, sure, Mom, sure. Yeah, you may work on your book. But yeah, you have to be very creative, but it's also hard just to even be motivated after you're just tired of from being a mom and being a wife and being having a job, a day job or whatever. It has to be hard to get back in that place of creating.
You know, what's been helpful is this actually is another time suck, but doing things I used to do before having a kid, just to prove that I do have an attention span that's more than like 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. So like reading a whole book is something that I'm like, I can do this. I can sit and like be interested.
On your phone.
Yeah. I can show interest. Like, yeah. So doing things I used to do beforehand. I realize I'm one of the few cartoonists who like exercise regularly and like intentionally. I realize that's not a thing. So I used to be a big runner. I haven't gotten back into that since having a kid because I have a pelvic floor issue. But you know, trying to do some kind of physical exercise again to prove to myself that I can do something for more than like a couple of minutes and it'd be gratifying and fulfilling and necessary.
You just said being a cartoonist so naturally. I loved it. So you have accepted your role.
You gotta own it.
That's what you are now?
Yeah, like it's like
every time I say cartoon, I still have to say, oh, I'm a teacher. I also draw comics on the side. So like, I love that you're just like, no, I'm a cartoonist now.
name it and then claim it.
Yes, exactly.
Nice. This is awesome.
Well, I'm totally looking forward to your new book, and I'm so glad that we had a chance to talk to you. And hopefully, when all this is over, we'll see each other at a convention or we'll all
Comic-Con.
Like,
yeah.
I missed that. I thought I didn't like crowds, but now that they don't exist, it kind of.
Hopefully, you'll let me hold your eyes here.
It's nice to have the option.
Yeah, it's nice to have that option of like not liking people.
Yeah,
hopefully next year we can go to Comic-Con together, and then we will see you get that your third Eisner.
Yeah.
Have a beer together. I'm drinking now. That's another thing. I didn't want to say another sustained practice is happy hour. My beer.
Well, thank you for talking to us today, Ebony.
Yeah.
Thanks for inviting me.
Pick up this book. Super amazing.
Thanks.
I thought it was great. I loved it so much. So,
do you have anything else you want to plug or direct attention towards?
I am on Twitter, kind of. I say kind of because I don't say like personal or not even personal. Like I don't spew out random thoughts. I have a New Yorker comic, and then I did the little spots, I think, for next week. I didn't know what spots were until, anyway, it's just little tiny pictures throughout the New Yorker.
Cool.
Very cool.
Thank you again, Ebony.
Thanks for talking to us.
You guys
take care.
Bye, buddies.